You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Very tempted to say, everybody out, to actually launch this past prologue. Sort of a line from the rag trade, Finn. It was a classic line there about dealing with union workers and everybody out. Anyway, you'll explain why, and why are we actually having a labour relations and strikes-based special on the latest edition of Past Prologue?
Well, if you've been following the news, you may have seen that the big event in the higher education sector in the last few months has been strikes over pensions, although not, in fact, at this particular institution, because we're in the other scheme. But it seemed an appropriate moment to think about some of the history of problematic labour relations, and so we are joined by Dr. Sam Shave, a recent arrival, who we're very pleased to have with us, and rejoined once again by Professor Philip Hoskin.
All of in the land of do what you told there.
Small print is what we agree. Sign your name before we teach you how to read. This is the land. This is the land of do what you're told. This is the land of do what you're told. With a little lip service to break in the mold. Smile a little wider as you're waiting to be sold. This is the land.
Going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet. They're filming it all for a reality show. So 12% we'll get.
This is the
We're
land.
Going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet.
This is the
They're
land.
They're filming it all for
the
a reality
land.
Show. So 12% we'll get.
This is the
We're
land.
Going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet.
This is the
They're
land.
They're filming it all for
the
a reality
land.
Show. So 12% we'll get.
This is the
We're
land.
Going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet.
This is the
They're filming it all for a reality show. So 12% we'll get. We're going on strike for 12%. We're not downhearted yet. They're filming it all for a reality show. So 12% we'll get.
Chumbawamba, the land of do what you're told. So I'm going to talk first to Sam, who works on the labouring poor in the 18th and 19th century. And I thought it might be interesting first just to ask you to say a bit about the kinds of sources that you use in order to access these voices.
There are quite a few different sources. We're quite lucky, especially by the 19th century, for looking at voices. So we have, we have depositions that were created during court cases. So we can see what people did in terms of, in terms of what. Could you ask the question again?
So we access their voices through court cases.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, I mean, do they leave? Because I'm assuming there must be limits on literacy and things in this period. Do we get any testimony direct from them, or is it kind of all filtered through the kind of systems with which they're working?
Well, it is more or less kind of, it's only with their brushes with authority that we get their voices. So it could be court cases, it could be a record of their threatening letters that they've sent, or any other type of correspondence if someone has... is writing on behalf of others, which often happens, that someone is able to put together a letter. One of the kind of most used source right now is probably the Old Bailey online, because it's so accessible. And then we do get a mixture of voices from the labouring classes.
So through these sources, how are they, what sort of incidences of labour conflicts and labour struggles are we finding?
So through the sources themselves, there are lots of different types of struggles that we can get an understanding of. Do you want me to give an example?
Yes.
So I've been working quite a lot on the records of one individual. Her name's Praxall Alfred Hinwood, and she... was really angry that her poor relief had changed. So she had received outdoor relief. She had received a mixture of outdoor relief and employment, quite low wages. And that was enabling her to survive sort of outside the workhouse. But because the Victorian poor law came along, everyone had to receive indoor relief, and she was asked to step into the workhouse instead of living independently. She was incredibly angry about this. And by accident, I came across some really fascinating documents that contain her kind of, what she had done. So she had, on two occasions, broken workhouse windows. She didn't want to be in there at all. She'd also had several arguments and several fights. But in these court records, I have three threatening letters from her to both... the welfare administrator and the workhouse master. Eventually, due to the severity of those letters, she was transported to Van Diemen's Land. So part of my research has been kind of looking at those resistances and why she had to resort to this kind of direct action and threatening letters. And then sort of looking at that trajectory in terms of how the state deals with someone who doesn't want to be within the system that's set up.
So can I ask you, for the benefit of people who don't know much about the period,
yeah.
to explain a bit more about how this sort of the overall structure in which this is happening. So you, you're mentioning the workhouse and the different types of poor law and poor relief.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so around Elizabethan times, poor relief was set up to be something that people could obtain. They could obtain money or bread from the parish vestry. So the vestry would meet and decide who to give money to, essentially. So you could live independently. And it was only later...
So that's a kind of I suppose a prototype unemployment.
That's it.
Insurance.
Yeah. They did seek to differentiate what they called deserving and undeserving poor, but because there were 15,500 parishes, they all did that differently. Then later, during the economic crisis of the 1790s kind of onwards, the deterrent workhouse became a popular mechanism by which to kind of just offer relief, but it had to be in a workhouse. You couldn't obtain money necessarily in these parishes that had this deterrent workhouse. The Victorian Poor Law, 1834, formalised that system, and everywhere had to have a deterrent workhouse. So Praxall here was kind of resisting that change. She had a life outside of the workhouse. It was supplemented by various different things, including the poor, in poor relief. But then... You know, she couldn't live independently without poor relief, so she had to go into a workhouse.
Is it to do with, do you think, primarily the loss of independent status that's obviously associated with, if I'm understanding correctly, obviously associated with being moved into the workhouse? Or is it also to do with the conditions when you're in the workhouse, that in theory, I suppose one would assume that it must be better if you're destitute outside, you're better off to be inside, but that actually that might not really be the case?
That's it. So the regime in a workhouse was hard. Work was stigmatizing. Women would be picking oakum for hours a day. Men would be crushing bones or stones down into fine powder. This is deliberately stigmatising, particularly the workhouses from 1834 onwards. You would lose a lot of independence, for a vast quantity, periods of time. Newspapers were banned, visiting rights, leaving the workhouse was an issue, and the division of people like a prison, men and women separate from girls and boys, all part of that architecture, that panopticon design of the workhouse. So you wouldn't want to go in. It's a place of last resort, essentially.
Does it break up families as well? Or is it usually the single person who finds himself in this position?
No. Many families entered, large labouring families. And it did break up the family. And we need more research on this as to whether... say, for instance, couples were allowed to stay together, and there's a huge argument that they should have been allowed to stay together because they were married, and that links to kind of Victorian morality. So we do need more research on that. I do know that mothers were allowed to see children in some workhouses for sort of periods of time, and they actually might have been their carers in the workhouse system because they used sort of the internal labour force as such. So women would be nursing, doing the laundry, that kind of thing.
And to come back to, is it Praxall, your particular case? You were saying, so she's fighting to, she's moved into this workhouse because she's essentially destitute, and then she's fighting to get out because of the loss of independence and conditions in the workhouse, and she ends up being transported. Presumably that's not much better as a fate.
No, but we can say that she expressed herself in a system that was it wasn't designed for women. It was designed, the new poor law was designed to deal with the agricultural male labourer, the surplus labourer, as they called it. And many policymakers at the time were calling the labouring poor the kind of slave class. Because they they were sort of undermined. The economic crisis of the 1790s onwards had basically reduced them down to receiving poor relief or in a situation of unemployment. So going back, just, you know, you could say at least she expressed herself. She wasn't being heard. But the other things that she'd asked for or the people she talked to clearly hadn't worked. And it's, you know, patriarchal society. Why would they listen to a single mother in particular?
So she does, in a sense, have some agency then, by even if it means transportation beyond the British Isles. There is a degree of power in getting out of the place that she doesn't want to be in.
That's right. Can I read a threatening letter of hers? So she the third letter that she sent, the one she got transported for, was to the workhouse master. And just going to read it out. And essentially it says, "Mr. Thomas Slade Whiting, I've sent you these lines just to give you warning that before this month is over, you shall have your farm and property destroyed by fire. What corn you intend sending to market, send as quick as you can, for you shall not send any more. This is the articles I use." And that she's referring to a fictitious match. She's drawn a match on a piece of paper and inserted it in the letter. So this is the articles I use and I shall use. "But if you do not want it in a blaze, you must not let me come into your parish. But you shall suffer for it, and I will do it. Let me be wherever I may be, for I will do it. And your police nor any other shall stop me." So she's got no regard for authority, because she's had brushes with the police before.
It's very vivid. Picture this furious woman.
Yeah.
Reduced to this. It's
She's angry. Striking. She can't make an independent living outside. You know, she's been told to enter the workhouse. It's just not the life she wants.
Do we know anything about what happens to her after she's, in a sense, I suppose, won something of a victory in at least getting out of the workhouse?
Yeah, so I've traced her life. So she came from Wiltshire, and she was in the Warminster Union workhouse. Her final trial did lead her to transportation, and she then went on a boat. Forgotten the name of the boat, but she ends up in Van Diemen's Land, Launceston, and she serves most of her sentence, but near the end she's absent without leave, and her sentence is extended. Essentially, she was undertaking hard labour. I think she was very unwell at this point. Her son that she had with her, that went with her to Van Diemen's Land, was apprenticed out. And there are descendants in Van Diemen's Land of Praxall today. But she died soon after coming back, being absent without leave. And it was within a week of going back to hard labour that she perished.
It's in the evening after dark, when the blackleg miner creeps to work, with his moleskin pants and dirty shirt. There goes the blackleg miner. Well, he grabs his duds and down he goes to hew the coal that lies below. There's not a woman in this town row will look at the blackleg miner.
I rub wet clay in the blackleg's face, and around the heaps I run a foot race to catch the blackleg miner. I'm dipping gang near the sickle mine. Across the way they stretch a line to catch the throat and break the spine of the dirty blackleg. Right. swell and they hoy them down the bitter hill. Down you go, there you well, you dirty blackleg miner. Oh, it's in the evening after dark that the blackleg miner creeps to work with his moleskin pants and dirty shirt. There goes the blackleg miner.
Steel Eye spans the blackleg version of the blackleg miner. So we're going to turn now, go a bit further back in time, as we often do, and speak to Philippa about labour relations in medieval times. But I was thinking, having had the privilege last night to, before we recorded this, to hear Philippa's inaugural lecture, where you were talking about the idea that often with the kinds of medieval records you've worked on, people have tended to think of them as telling us a lot about sort of history from the top down, a lot less about history from the bottom up. And I was just wondering how one goes about in the medieval times finding out, finding out about the, as it were, the ordinary working person.
Yes, you're right. The documents that we have largely do look like top-down records, created by sort of high-level administration, high-level courts. So you're not looking even for the sorts of records that Sam was talking about, depositions of witness statements, letters written by, say, labourers, either in towns or in the country. You're trying to draw information out of records that were created by those in charge of them. But you can see behind those records, the negotiations that labourers are going through, what's going on at sort of lower level.
So do we find anything, any parallel to labour disputes, to unions, to anything like that in your era?
Well, there are certainly labour disputes. And if we think about, say, the 14th and 15th centuries, where the records are fuller and it's clearer, they're different if you're in the town or if you're in the country. So if you're in the country, in particularly 14th century, say, England, just after the Black Death, so when about 60% of the population have died, there's a lot of tension about land ownership. The lords who own the land are trying to get higher rents out of their tenants because, of course, they've got a lot of land they can't let at all. But the tenants' reaction is basically to do what they shouldn't have been able to do at all. They leave. And that is how they deal with those disputes. Most of them are unfree. That is, they don't have the right to leave their land. They have to do what their lord says. About 70% of the population in England is unfree. But if they can go to the towns and if they can work there for a year and a day, then they become free. They become citizens of those towns. And that's what they do. They go to the towns grow up, some of them work as servants, for example. They may go back and rent land later, but they are reacting to that, to those sorts of labour demands by saying, you know, no more do we have to be here. We can go where we want.
I'm just interested in this idea of being unfree. So obviously you're tied to, or in theory you're tied to the land. Are there a lot of other restrictions on how you can live, how things you can do in that environment?
Yeah, because you're tied to the land, you can't take land from another lord without permission. But all the bits of your life are at least officially organised by your lord. So if your father dies and you want to take over his property, you have to go to the Lord's Court and get permission to do it. If you want to marry, you should go to the Lord's Court and get permission to do it. If you want to make a will, you have to get permission from your lord. And there are other things that you shouldn't ever be able to do. You shouldn't be able to make legal agreements on your own behalf. You shouldn't be able to act as a witness in a court. People often did those things anyway, and lords rarely refused you the rights to marry or to make a will, but you had to go and ask, and you are tied. And if you did try to leave the land in times when they could make you come back, they would drag you back again.
Mm. And we were talking about the idea that they, this fact that they seem to be able to leave in this period after the Black Death, even though they as you say, they weren't supposed to. And I was wondering why it is that, is this different from it, from other points in the same sort of broad time frame, that is this exceptional, and what were the circumstances?
Yeah, yes, it is exceptional. It's all about population levels. In the very early 14th century, there's a real population boom. So there's a real struggle to get land. And, of course, that means the Lord can put any restrictions he wants on it, because he can also throw you off. That's the other thing about being unfree. The Lord can get rid of you. And then there is a large famine. There's a reduction in the number of people on the land. And then there's the Black Death, which kills large numbers. Now, as soon as you have more land than you have tenants, it's a buyer's market. So lords will accept people trying to get to them from other lords, even though they know it's not reasonable. And if your son or daughter say, nope, I don't want to work for you anymore, I'm going to the town, it's very unlikely now that their parents are going to suffer any penalties, because the lord cannot afford to put any penalties on them. They'll leave too.
Does this provoke any problematic relations at the sort of lordly level? I'm just wondering whether if they're doing the thing they're not supposed to, and you know, say Lord A's workers are all rushing off to take service with Lord B, you know, you're suddenly getting, I don't know, not pistols at dawn, obviously, but some sort of, you know, furious correspondence going back and forward or
Well, we get laws. We get laws about how much you should pay labourers, basically trying to make it not so attractive to go into the towns. Because as far as they can see, you know, their answers say, well, let's put them all back on the land again. That makes sense. That's how it always works. We just don't want these people in these towns that have been growing up from sort of the 13th century particularly. Let's make it so that they all have to go back on the land, and then it'll be sorted out. But of course it doesn't work.
Is that just because they can't move the people around so easily, as people just refuse to be moved around in this way?
Yes, people refuse to be moved around. And, of course, there is also going to be a reduction, a sort of demand for labour in the towns. So you are going to pay your servants as much as you need to keep them. Otherwise, they'll just move on to another town. They don't need to stay with you.
I'll come on to the towns a bit more in a second. I was just going to ask you, if in the earlier period, if the Lord does throw you off the land, his land, for whatever reason, what options have you got? Are you looking at a very desperate situation from which there are very few ways out, or are there? Do you have possible solutions?
There are not many possible solutions. You would be destitute. You'd be reliant upon alms. Of course, almsgiving is important. Giving to the poor is an important part of people's lives, because it's an important part of their spiritual duty. So you may well find that you do receive those, that you do get those gifts of alms. But you are, you know, that's what you're going to be reliant on. But that's what you're reliant on as well if you are, say, the remaining elderly woman in a family whose male relatives have all died and you can't work the land.
Because, of course, there's no structure otherwise. There's no state structure. There's no real structure in the on the estate to look after those people.
No, the structure is charity. Occasionally you'll see in manorial records something like the oak that came down in the last storm we'll give to old Mrs. So-and-so. But again, it's about almsgiving. There's no idea that we would always give wood to the poor who need it.
Yes, I'm having visions now of people nipping out in storms and arranging to chop down more trees in the hope of receiving them.
Yeah.
So we've got all these people moving into the towns. To what extent do they, obviously after a year and a day, I think you were saying that then they automatically attain to a difference to a free estate. To what extent before that do they have more freedom about the kind of work they're doing, more control over their lives?
Yeah, that's really, I think, what they're aiming at. They are going to have more freedom about the sort of work they do. They can almost choose for themselves. Of course, it has to work, but they can. So a lot of them do go to be servants, but a lot of them go to do jobs that you have a suspicion that they were doing on the land. You know, I'm a baker. I always sold some bread for people. I always brewed. Well, I'll go and do it in the town. And, of course, in the 14th and 15th century, there's the growth of the merchant class as well. And then the merchants need workers. So you can go from working for a lord in the country where you're unfree to working for a merchant in the towns where now you're basically a free person. You're still working for someone for wages, but you're free.
So, but presumably if you're working on the land, you're not... Are you paid wages? Or you just get subsistence from it? So there is also a difference...
You would have to get subsistence from it, and you would hope to be able to sell some of your produce. Mm. Yeah.
And you were mentioning before when we were talking about this in advance of the programme, that interesting things are happening in relation to the development of clocks.
Yeah, the development of ideas about time are very much connected to labour relations in the Middle Ages and to the ways in which people protest about their rights or their conditions. 14th and 15th century, particularly on the continent, but also in England, in big cities like York, say, there's a growth of big city clocks that mark the time for everybody. You know, with proper chimes, but they're marking different sorts of time. Up to then, the chimes you've had that mark the time are organised by the church. So they mark church time, church services, and time is seen as something sort of eternal. You know, you move from your life to the afterlife. Now, time is something that comes in hours and minutes and days, marked by a big clock in the town. And that's for the merchant's benefit, largely. It's often put up by civic authorities, but it's the merchants who want it because they want to control how long their workers are working. Those are the debates you get. Those are the protests you get. When you get riots in the towns amongst workers and protests amongst workers, and you do, what they're protesting about isn't how much they're paid or what they have to do. It's how long they have to work because they can now be tied to that.
So are we getting into the sort of age of saying, you know, I want an hour off to pop round the corner to the bakers and these kind of things? Or is it just a sort of raw thing about we're only prepared to work, say, 9 hours or I don't know how many hours it would have been? But
I mean, there would have been always probably a sense of working maybe sunrise to sunset. Mm. And, you know, at the middle of the day, the church chimes for service and we all go and get lunch. But now there's an idea that you will work this hour to this hour, even if it's not, you know, even if it's dark, because that's how we can work you. And, yes, a consciousness of how much time you might get off during that day.
And does the church have an attitude to some of this? Because it's interesting, I just was interested in this idea that you're moving from a kind of religious, or what seems to be a religious idea about time, with this, you know, moving through your life into the eternal life, into this more... an idea of time that's more determined by immediate sort of human concerns, I suppose.
Yeah, the church sort of adapt their teaching, really. So they start to focus far more in sermons and in writings on the actual use of time, making good use of your sort of every minute, every hour, every day, which isn't something that they have pushed particularly before that. It was making good use of your life. So they adapt themselves to fit with these new ideas of time.
And it's perhaps also just worth asking, how are they also reacting to the riots? I mean, presumably the merchants and others of that kind, the lords, are very worried about any kind of unrest. Is the church coming in, being drawn into that sort of debate at all?
We don't see it very clearly, but that would be because of the sorts of records that we have. It's going to be easiest to see those usually from the point of view of court records. And so we're dealing with the secular courts, really, because they are the ones who would try those sorts of things, or with legislation coming out of the towns. Where you will see the church's opinion is sometimes in literature. Where you'll see poems like, you know, Piers Plowman making sort of comments about good lords and bad lords. And that has that sort of feeling of how you should treat your workmen.
dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a Union town, all down the line. This is a Union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a Union town, all down the line. Today the policeman's a Union man, brother firefighter's my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the Union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a Union town, all down the line. This is a Union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a Union town, all down the line. That's why my friend the blood tastes good every time I'm here. I got a will to win and a Cheshire grin. Yeah, the night watchman is near, and you can't get it where you're at, but you can sure get it here. So come rain or sleet or dark or night, come wind or frigid snow, there's 100,000 in the streets, and that number's gonna grow. And when we put the governor on trial, I'll be in the front row. Just take a look around, we're a Union town. 1, 2, 3, 4, let's go. This is a Union town, all down the line. This is a Union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a Union town, all down the line.
Tim Morello's Union Town. We do have fun picking songs for these shows. So I want to come back to you, Sam, and we were talking before about this individual case and the way that Praxall rebels against the system and perhaps to some extent achieves a result from that. And I was wondering, how common is that as an act for people in this position, or is it much more the case that they accept the... you know, accept what the state forces them to do?
It's one of those situations where we need more research. This is the first case that I've come across out of all the Paula records that I've looked at and parish records during this period of one person rebelling against the system to that extent. But just looking at prison lists on there, we have people in prison throughout the 18th and 19th century who have assaulted workhouse masters, have assaulted the overseers, and employers. So, it's debatable, actually, how common. I mean, Praxall, her case, this is 1840s, we just had the swing riots in the 1830s. And here we're talking about a huge, huge labouring class movement across the south of England and East Anglia, which 2,000 people were put on trial for. And they were very angry about the under and unemployment they're experiencing during social and economic decline. So we do have these big moments of protest. And then we have these individual ones as well to kind of unpick and examine further, I think.
No, I don't. You've obviously said a little bit about it there, but I must confess I haven't come across the swing riots before. Why are they called? How did they acquire the name?
The name Swing Right, well, it comes from the anonymous letters that started in a place called Elam in Kent, and various kind of copycat letters. They're anonymous letters, but they depicted, they called it Captain Swing. They signed off the letters Captain Swing, and it relates to the gallows, i.e. we are going to put you, the landowners, on trial.
Goodness, that must have been quite alarming.
Yes,
for the landowners.
They were terrified. They were really terrified. And, you know, at various times, troops had to be deployed to suppress this angry movement. And they were terrified, actually, because the tactics were so varied. You had both the overt tactics of, you know, gathering and demanding better wages, mm-hmm. not being reduced to this parish poor relief. And then you have the covert tactics as well, and they're really varied. So you have everything from destroying threshing machines to the anonymous letters promising incendiarism on your farm and all your property. You know, it's a deliberate kind of attack on property, but also very upsetting cases of animal maiming and plant maiming as well.
And were most of these two, because clearly there must have been quite a lot then of successful acts of resistance in these riots in order to produce 2,000 people to go to trial. Do they mostly, what happens to those people? Is there any pushback against the legal process? Do they get just sort of carted off back to workhouses and prisons?
Yeah. Parliament was incredibly worried. It was them. These MPs, these landowners that they were connected to, those making the policy decisions, those controlling, kind of the system as such. They set up a special commission and which toured across the south of England and East Anglia, and of the 2,000 people, I've got some stats here. 252 people were sentenced to death. But 19 were hanged, 644 were imprisoned, and 481 were transported to Australia.
And do we get the sense that it does act successfully as a deterrent? Because obviously that's a very harsh set of responses to it. Or do we see that it kind of goes, unrest goes underground, as it were, for a while, and then resurfaces?
Yeah, it does tail off. Because of that, the suppression was so effective, but we see it resurfacing, particularly when the new poor law is implemented. Because here we have the removal of these long-held entitlements that we've had since the Elizabethan era to get money outside of a workhouse to kind of supplement the wage, and they rebelled against the new poor law because they were seasonal workers; they did need a top up. When they weren't working agriculturally, on the land, they needed a top up. So there were riots, particularly in the north, actually, in Oldham, Huddersfield, and in Bradford. And in the latter case, they had to deploy troops again to suppress the rioting here. But in the south of England, there were lots of riots too. So the home of the Swing Riots, they were also protests as well. So it kind of bubbled up again.
Had the government thought, just quickly, and I must bring Philip in, had the government thought of the new poor law as a sort of response to these episodes of unrest? And do you think, do they get it wrong?
They do. Partly what inspires that Victorian workhouse system is the rebellious, the labouring class. When they were formulating the new poor law, in their famous queries, they called it, which they sent out to, provinces as such, they sent them out to all the parishes. One of the questions was, have you been affected by the Swing Riots? What happened in your locality? So it definitely informed that draconian measure, the Victorian deterrent stigmatising workhouse.
So it's much more about control, really, than about actually addressing the issues that might have produced the unrest.
So talking about, whether that was successful or not is a difficult question to ask, because on whose terms? Yeah.
Philip, I wanted to ask you, you were mentioning when we were talking before the way that legislation starts to, I think you said something about legislation in the town starting to come through to address some of these issues that we were discussing. Mm. And I was wondering, is that mirrored by, is there, you know, what kind of national legislation arrangements do we have at this point? Is it, you know, is it very much a set of relationships that, that where control is remains at the local level, perhaps with some sort of established customs, overarching customs, or is there a kind of any kind of national framework to compare with anything we see later on?
There are national laws as well as local ones. They do sort of work on both levels. So if we are thinking particularly about the labouring poor leaving the land, things like the Statute of Labourers, the Ordinance of Labourers, which try to limit the amount that you could pay somebody for certain jobs, limit people's right to move around, limit people's right to wear even particular clothes. They're tied into sumptuary laws, laws about what you can wear, how you can appear. Those are national. If we're talking about laws that control things like the riots or that deal with your duty to deal with your particular merchant lord, maybe, those tend to be more local. And, of course, local lords of the manor have their own courts in rural England, say, and they will have their own laws and their own negotiations and their own sets of rules, ordinances as well.
Can you appeal local decisions upwards, or are you sort of stuck, once the Lord's Court or the town council or equivalent have decided on a case, you're stuck with it?
It depends on the sort of case you're dealing with. If your dispute is about a Lord's land and you go to the Lord's Court, then you're more or less stuck. You could try appealing directly to the king. From the later 13th century onwards, you could use the process of private petitioning, sending a sort of request to the king saying, I need this, this is my situation. He may deal with it, he may pass it on to a particular other court, but he may just send you straight back to your lord, because he will know how the parliament will know how the law works.
Yes, and presumably it's a very slow process given the communication limitations of the...
It's a slow process. It's an expensive process because you need to get somebody to produce something formal in London, and you often had to go to London to get that done because they were the people who knew how to do it by the 14th century. And it's not a very certain process. You can ask for something, you can spend the money asking for it, you don't know if you'll get it.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left, took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Well, I've been working in this factory for now 15 years. All this time I've watched my woman drowning in a pool of tears. Well, I've seen a lot of good folk die, had a lot of bills to pay. I'd give the shirt right off my back if I had the guts to say, take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. The woman done left, took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way, cause I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. Foreman, he's a regular dog. The line boss, he's a fool. He's got a brand new flat top haircut. Lord, he thinks he's cool. One of these days I'm gonna blow my top, and that sucker, he's gonna pay. Lord, I can't wait to see their faces when I get the nerve to say, take this job and shove it.
ain't working here no more. A woman done left, took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way, 'cause I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it, I ain't working here no more. Take this job and shove it.
Johnny Paychecks, the uniquely named Johnny Paychecks, Take This Job and Shove It. So we're rapidly coming to the end of another edition of Past Prologue. I'm going to bring you both in a moment, but I just wanted quickly to pick up on one thing, Philippa, that you mentioned in the last segment. I'm interested in this fact that they passed laws restricting what kind of clothing people could wear. And I just wondered, are there particular reasons for that?
It's about what class you can pass as. If you are really from the labouring class, but you've moved to a town and you make a lot of money as a servant, and you could, and then you can afford to wear bright colours, velvets, nobody will know that you are a member of the labouring class. They won't know how to treat you. And it might give you ideas above your station, basically. So they want to keep you in certain sorts of very simple clothes, very simple colours.
Depressing thought, really. So we were talking a bit of, or quite a lot, about the way that the, as it were, the labouring classes in both these periods are trying in different ways to get their concerns heard higher up the chain. In some cases by rioting, in some cases by writing threatening letters, potentially by going down to London and paying sums of money to petition the. To petition the king. Do we have much sense that any of this is being listened to? Do you want to go first, Sam?
I can do. Well, in the case of the swing riots and some individuals' cases, sometimes there are people that are listening, particularly the clergy. They're concerned about the labouring poor, they're concerned about their parishioners. They will, on their behalf, sometimes campaign for their welfare and their well-being. And they will sometimes write letters to MPs, and MPs might then, in the 19th century, read these statements out in Parliament, and then hopefully create a change. And I've got an example of that in one case. This person was becoming very unwell in a workhouse from grinding bones. It was a very controversial form of work. He was becoming incredibly unwell and needed lots of medical attention. His man called William Smith, and his concerns did reach Parliament. It was taken up by a Chartist candidate for Brighton in the 1840s, and that pamphlet was written, and then that went to the MP for Brighton, and he read that out in Parliament, and actually within 5 years that working practice was banned. There's other circumstances, but it fed into that process.
Good to see the wheels of Parliament moving as swiftly as ever. Philippa?
I think in, say, the 14th and 15th centuries, yes, people are hearing it. What they are hearing, though, is that they need to get better control over people. So they're not hearing that they need to do something to alleviate people's concerns. They're not hearing that they need to reduce working hours particularly. And they're not hearing people saying that they want to move around more, and they're not facilitating that. What they're hearing is that people want to do things that they don't want them to do, and they need to stop that.
So it's a kind of, it's very much still this threat to the fundamental social order.
Yeah.
The other thing I was... If I've time for one quick question. Do you think there's anything we can draw in the present day from these historical labour relations that might be of use?
I suppose the concerns that the workers have are often very much the same, aren't they? They're about autonomy, they're about the conditions in which they work.
I think it's a question of in my research anyway, it's about who's listening and how that can then create change, or how things can improve. There are these moments of that innovation, of that change, and so it's thinking about that today that's of interest as well. Who's listening?
Question that I suspect the university lecturers have been asking themselves in recent weeks. So we have rushed to the end of another edition of Past Prologue. I would like to thank, as always, my guests, Dr. Sam Shave and Professor Philippa Hoskin, and also Alex Levchuk for keeping us on the air and sorting out the music and doing all the clever technical things that make the show happen. And Past Prologue will be back in about a month's time. Thank you for listening.
That it's all just a little bit of history repeating.